Good morning. How is everybody doing today? We doing all right? We got some energy? I know it's been a stormy, rainy weekend. And if you are anything like us and you have dogs, dogs don't always sleep so well during those storms. But we are here and we're full of energy and the love of the Holy Spirit, and that's all we can ask for. We're continuing our series through Ruth, and I'm going to ask a funny question. Have you ever noticed the way we tend to talk about McDonald's? It's funny, and maybe it's just in the circles that I work around. The more sophisticated you get, the more you have to deny that you've ever been to McDonald's. So you talk to people and they're like, if they bring up McDonald's, and have you heard about McDonald's? Not that I've ever eaten there. And you look here and they've served over 99 billion people. And there is a line that wraps around their double drive-through. So it feels a little disingenuous when somehow everyone you ever talk to, well, I rarely or never eat at McDonald's, but somebody's eating there. And the truth is, you know, none of us brag about picking up a sandwich at McDonald's. And it used to be like a good deal. You know, I remember the dollar menu where you could get a double cheeseburger for a buck. And it was, if you were in a hurry, it wasn't nutritious, it wasn't great, but, you know, it did the job. Now I think it's like $4 or something crazy, so I'm not in there as often as maybe I once was. Plus, the waistline doesn't need it. But it's funny, we deny this thing because we want to present a picture of ourselves, we want people to think of us in a certain way. It's hard for us to admit that we eat junk food when we all do. Well, the same thing can be said about romance novels. This is funny. This is a real cover of a romance book, Wings of Desire. If you didn't see there, that's Colonel Sanders from Kentucky Fried Chicken on the cover. This was part of a promotion they did for Mother's Day. Believe it or not, Kentucky Fried Chicken's biggest day of the year in sales is Mother's Day. It's when they sell the most family buckets because Dad said, probably shouldn't make Mom cook today. So that's their big day. They did a promotion. They included a free romance novel for Mom when you bought their family bucket of chicken. But where they went wrong is they didn't make the satirical. Everyone thought when they saw Colonel Sanders on the cover of the romance novel that it would be satirical, that it would be funny, that there would be a lot of jokes. But it turned out they just bought a kind of straight novella romance and did a find and exchange and put Colonel Sanders in. So it wasn't very good. It was a big backlash. Nobody liked it. But romance novels are one of those other things you would ask people about, and everybody's like, no, I don't read those. But somehow they're the number one adult fiction category of books. And the second isn't even close. 25% of books sold to adults, fiction books, are romance novels. And at 25%, the second is a distant second at 12%. And that is all of mystery, murder, and suspense all boiled into one. There are tons of romance genres. There's fantasy and medieval romance. There's all sorts of modern categories. But the point is, we care about love stories. We long to experience that for ourselves. We long to hear these things and think about these things. And I would argue it's because we're somewhat hard-coded to do so. When I look at the average age of our conversation and we look at the story of Ruth and Boaz and the love story, part of me asks the question, is this really the message my congregation wants to hear? Because many of them are long past the courtship days, and I understand that. And some of you may say, and I've had this before, I did a message about, I think years ago about, and we dealt with, because the text dealt with the idea of cohabitation and premarital sex. I had so many of you come to me and say, Pastor Jeff, you kind of missed your mark on the audience here. But one, there are some younger people here who will go through a courtship. And two, If 25% of books sold are love stories and romance, you can't tell me that that's not built into us. And so today what I want us to do is understand the anatomy of a love story when done God's way. Because there's a few big pieces here. One, some of our young people, I want to be able to go through that love story correctly, the way that God designed it. Second, there are some of you who have some hurts and wounds. Maybe you, like Naomi, have changed your name to bitterness because you've gone through love stories that haven't worked out. And I think understanding the way that God designed it is good, and it can be part of the healing process. And finally, we see even Naomi, the old woman in our story, she played a pivotal role, not in manipulating Ruth, but in supporting her, even knowing kind of where this was going before Ruth did. Naomi was a support without being overbearing or controlling. And the truth is, nothing happens in an echo chamber or in a silo. It happens in community. And so we're going to look at those angles and we're going to see what God's doing. But I do believe, while we may say, oh, I'm not interested in a romance story, it's ingrained within us. And we're going to learn about how Ruth and Boaz, how that story of redemption and kinship and love, how that happened God's way. And it sets finally the tone for the end of the book of Ruth. We're going to transition with the narrative that it fits into God's redemptive plan for us. We talked about this, but Ruth is the great-grandmother of David. And Ruth is a part of that lineage and genealogy that goes all the way down later to Jesus. This Moabite woman, born not to the people of God, not to a tribe of Israel, but an outsider who is welcomed in, who is adopted into the family of God, redeemed and made special, made important, and used by God for greatness. I think that's part of the way that we're wired to desire that God could take our pain, could take our flaws, that He could lift our eyes up to them, and He would redeem us and help us to be part of His work. That's what Ruth's love story culminates in. It's not just a love story between Ruth and Boaz. Ruth and Boaz is a love story that then points to a love story with God, one that we can all be a part of. So we're going to read. So we are wired to respond to love stories, and understanding Ruth's will help us understand our own. It's a way more concise way to say what I just spent 5 minutes on. Starting in Ruth chapter 2, we'll start in verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech. So Elimelech was Naomi's husband who died. So this is a man that was related to Elimelech. He was part of the family, not on Naomi's side, but on her deceased husband's side, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabite, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I have found favor." This is significant because as we left chapter 1, Naomi changed her name. She said, "My name is not hopeful anymore. I am not cheerful." Naomi means pleasant. If your wife or if a woman in your life says, "I have changed my name from pleasant to bitter," you've got some hard conversations up ahead. That's not great. Naomi's in a rough spot. She's coming back. She knows that she was from this tribe, but now she's coming back an outsider. If you missed all that, you can download last week's message on the website. It'll give a lot of context. But Naomi is bitter. She is not happy. And the text said she went out multiple times to anyone who would listen and made sure they knew. Not pleasant, bitter. That's my new name. So in the context of that, Naomi now goes out and she says, "I am going to go and put myself out there because we need to eat, because we have needs. And we'll talk more about this next week, but she engages in this social safety net that Israel had of gleaning. So they intentionally didn't do the most efficient, best job possible to get all the little last pieces of grain when they would harvest a field. They left that to the poor. So if you didn't have anything, you could go, and it wasn't always easy. And the fact that she was a Moabite and known for that, that gave her some risk because it was the people of God that were invited into that, not necessarily the outside nations. So she could have been given a rough time from those around her. In the same way that we kind of hear about that in our own things today, it's, you know, it's hard to have an open border and a social safety net. We can invite everybody to come, but we also then have the cost of how do we feed and clothe and how do we take care of everybody? And our politicians don't like to have that conversation. We can have one or the other, but having both is like just never worked. Not that I don't want to be generous and have an open border. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's some reality things and there's some tensions there that have to be lived in. And here there's this tension where they're saying, hey, we're going to feed our poor, but we don't want to feed the poor from over there. And Ruth is coming into that, a Moabite woman. She's not born from here. She's an alien, an outsider, an immigrant. So she puts herself out there. Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. Naomi said to her, go ahead, my daughter. So she went out, entered the field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who is related to her father-in-law, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you, they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, who does that young woman belong to? And again, this is old language. It's not necessarily meant to be heavily possessive, but he's pretty much saying, who's that woman married to? Not that she's property, but she caught his eye. The overseer replied, she is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. She came into the field and has remained there from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So I want to begin by looking at Ruth, and we're going to get into the rest of the story here as we go. But despite Naomi's grief, Ruth believed God is good. And she steps into uncertainty, but we have to see that her reputation goes before her. It's important in the midst of all of these headwinds, the fact that she's likely not to be, and the assumption would be not welcomed into the harvest, into the field. She says, let me go off into the field. Maybe someone will take pity. Maybe someone will have compassion upon me. Let me see what happens. Let me put myself out there. That's important. Because too often we limit God by not taking the first step when we don't see where step 3, 4, and 5 will go. And some of this, it's super easy to make fun of generations. And as I'm going to make fun of a younger generation, just realize that the younger kids, they make fun of us pretty hard too. But I've employed a lot of what we call like Gen Z, I guess, would be the younger than millennial generation. And it's been funny because I've told them, I need you to call this person. And they look terrified. What do you mean call them? Like, well, I need you to, we have this thing, it's called a telephone. I need you to dial this number, and I need you to talk to them because the question, there's like multiples, and they all are contingent upon the previous question. So if we were to try and go back and forth with email, I'll find my answer in 2 weeks. So I need you to call them. And they're like, but what if they don't answer? Like, that is part of the social contract of a phone call. You can leave a message. But they were so consumed, like somehow they'd be devastated if they called and the rejection of the phone not being answered on the other end. And again, trust me, this generation, they've got plenty of little flaws they pick out on us. So we've got our things too. But we don't put ourselves out there. We don't take the next step. And if we don't do that, we get stuck, never even starting. Naomi had a lot of frustration and bitterness in the home, and Ruth had every excuse to say, I guess we'll just sit here until God either dumps food on our doorstep or we die, two widows together. They could have had the biggest pity party, but they didn't. And Ruth showed this. She showed this when she chose to leave Moab. She could have gone home to her parents' household and she could have worshipped the same false gods that her parents worshipped. But she said, Naomi, I'm going to go where you go. I'm going to die where you die. We will be together. We're family. And now she goes out and she said, I don't care if I'm going to be beaten in the field because I'm picking more grain than somebody next to me who thinks they deserve it. I'm going to put myself out there and I'm going to trust that God is good. I'm going to trust his provision. I'm going to trust that he has good things in store for me. See, that's hope in action. We can say that we're hopeful, but if we don't take a next step, then we don't really have hope and we don't really have faith. Because if we believe something, it will fundamentally affect the way that we act. If someone says, I believe that this stock is going to go up, one of the first questions you should probably ask before you put your own money in, have you invested in it? Oh, no, I didn't put any money in it, but I believe it. I know it's going to go to the moon. But then why didn't you put, like, even a dollar? They don't really believe it if their actions don't play it out. And for Ruth, her actions take the hope that she has, the faith that she has, and God rewards it. But it doesn't begin unless it gets started. And I'm not limiting God here because God has amazing ways that he can take our stubbornness and he can work around it. He can do it. But Ruth doesn't wait for that. She takes the first step. And that step of proximity is important. The text continues in verse 8. So Boaz said to Ruth, my daughter, and he's not talking to her like somehow they're like father-daughter. That's not, don't take that. That's just language of fellow tribesperson, child of Israel, which is important because he's bringing her into the story, knowing that she's a Moabite. Listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field. And don't go away from here. He's recognizing that there really is danger for her outward. He's saying, stay here under my umbrella of protection. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you. Again, under his protection. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled. At this, they bowed down with her, she bowed down with her face to the ground, and she asked him, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? Boaz replied, I have been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants. At the mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all that she wanted and had some left over. At this, she got up to glean. Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley that she had gathered. That's where they crush it and separate the outer part from the inner part that they would eat. And it amounted to an ephah, which is a lot. This is like a few kilograms worth. So this is some bags of grain. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what was left over after she had had enough to eat. So this is the steamed or boiled grains. So we'll stop there and we'll continue. But I want to talk a little bit about Boaz, because I think this is important. Boaz, as a man, is showing both strength and kindness. Ruth is attracted to Boaz's godly masculinity, strength, and kindness. "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" So Boaz sees Ruth, and he makes it very clear. One of the things that I think we can assume, the way the text plays it out, that there's the first thing Boaz does, he before he learns about her virtue, he notices her with his eye. And that's going to be the truth for almost every romance, whether you're a young Christian person or you're some heathen living out in the world. You're going to notice somebody first with your eye. And he notices Ruth. But then he asks about her, and she asks the question, "Why have you noticed me? Why are you being kind to me and showing me compassion?" There was the noticing with the eye, but then what must have been even more important is after he found attraction to her, he heard about her virtue and her character. He heard the story that she left everything behind, that she came to be with Naomi, even though, as we already talked about, Naomi is such pleasant company right now. He's impressed by this. And a little bit about Boaz that we see inferred in the text, and some of it's going to come in chapter 3 and chapter 4, and we'll talk more about that as we go. But Boaz is not a real young man. Boaz is a wealthy man. He's a powerful man. And here we can see he's a good man. But he's not necessarily the youngest man. And if he's unmarried at this point, he may not even be the most physically attractive man. But there's a love story here anyways. And part of it, what Boaz notices, and we'll talk more about this next week, we're going to break down this idea of the kinship redeemer. It's a specific thing in Jewish and Levitical law in which one family member, again, not from the same side of the family tree, but from the deceased spouse's side of the family tree, can step in. It's a very sacrificial thing because they end up giving a part of their inheritance to that same side, whether it was their brother or cousin, that they're coming in and marrying his wife. It's not a marry multiple people thing either. It's a unmarried on this side can come in and can redeem. And Boaz falls into that. But as we're going to learn next week, Boaz isn't the closest. He's not the only option. But he really would like this to work. And part of why it does work is that despite not being the most attractive man in Israel, despite being older than Ruth, when there's proximity, Ruth is able to fall in love with and see the attractive strength in Boaz that isn't just on the surface. And for our young people today, this is one of the things that concerns me and sometimes keeps me up at night a little bit. When I work with trying to mentor young men and encourage them, we live in a world that's very different from the one that those of us over 40 grew up in. See, it used to be that if you wanted to go out with a young woman, if you wanted to ask her on a date, that you would have to, you know, in school or in church, you would get to know her a little bit, and then you would have that really brave step out where you would ask her to play mini golf or go out for dinner or whatever it may be. And you face the idea that you could be rejected. And while that was hard for generations, we've done that. But there was proximity there. Today, we have taken the hard part out of it, at least for some. And a lot of young people, especially those who are over 18, and I'm not criticizing this. I'm just pointing out one of the challenges that come from it. So if you met on an app, I'm not invalidating your relationship. Don't hear what I'm not saying. But the app where you swipe one direction and they swipe the other direction, and if you both like the picture, because let's face it, no one's really reading the biography, and no one's really telling the truth in the biography, so I can't blame them for not reading it. I saw something the other day, and they were saying, oh, you know, they say they're 6 feet tall. They're like, that really means like 5'5". And the other guy was like, you can lie on dating apps? Like, holy cow, I didn't know I could do that. But they're just looking at a physical picture. Not interested. And the imbalance there for men and women is severe. Because they say that women pick about 9%, and again, statistics are all over the place, so you can believe whoever you read, but one of the ones I picked up on said women take about 9% of the pictures that they see, men accept about 60% of the pictures that they see. But what's happening, unless a man is like an 8 or 9 or 10 on the scale of attractiveness, then those other men are invisible. They never get a swipe. No one ever says, I'm interested. And on the women's side of things, even women who would be rank themselves as not an 8 or 9 or a 10, they're only really looking and accepting the 8 or 9s or 10s from the men. And the problem is, if we're just judging appearance, what women are attracted to doesn't really work out. And one of the old adages, I remember there was even a song about it when I was a teenager, why do good girls like bad guys? And that's where men end up with. And in the church, sometimes I think we give terrible advice to young men. And we're like, yeah, I guess women just like bad guys. But the truth is that there's kind of a separate access for men and women. There's attractiveness, which looks at competency, physical attributes, strength. There's a lot wrapped up into that. And then on the other side, we have the things that make women choose to commit to a man. And that is going to be how kind they are, their spiritual maturity. But at the end of the day, it's not fair for anyone to walk up to any young person and say, you should be attracted to that person. That's not something that we get to just like generate in a person. And some of it is biology. Like, we don't even fully understand why. But Boaz, the historical record says he wasn't a 10. He was probably more like a 5. And he was older, which put him at a disadvantage. But when proximity was there and she got to see the fact that Boaz had strength, that he had competence, that he had skills, that he had a lot of things that were on that same scale, but those qualities don't happen on a picture that's just put on an app. And one of the biggest solutions we have to this is, two things. One is that we need to encourage young men to be strong. Because we live in a culture, and I'm not picking on anybody in particular, but we've told men, I think, in some ways, and I don't think it's even intentional, but to be passive, to not be strong. But when any survey is done, At the end of the day, even women who don't admit this, they say on the surveys privately that they're looking for a strong man. Women want to be protected and sheltered, even if they make more money and have their own skills. Women are looking for a competent, strong partner. And I'm raising competent, strong daughters. And so my prayer is, okay, God, I need you to bring along a competent, strong man that's going to be able to contend with those daughters someday. Otherwise, they're just going to roll over them. And so we as a church, we don't want quote-unquote toxic masculinity. And I'm not sure today I even know what that means. I know some of the traits. And I know there are definitely things that I grew up with in the day and age of over-sexualized movies like American Pie and all this other stuff. There are things that were called masculine in the locker room that I don't want my son to have anything to do with. But I also know that as a young man, one of the most formative times in my life didn't happen in a locker room. It happened in a Bible study that I wasn't supposed to be at. I was a fly on the wall doing my homework as the men, and my dad was part of it, were praying together and studying the Bible together. And at the very end, it wasn't even my dad. It was one of the other men in the group. And I knew that there were some complaints that maybe my dad should have gotten childcare and left me at home. But one of the other men who was the leader of the group called out and said, "Jeff, you're going to come pray with us. You're one of the men." I've got chills even now because I remember that was the moment that I was called into what is masculinity looks like. It's that we as men, we pray together, and I listened to them pray for their wives and their families fervently. And I was like, that's what it means to be a man. It's to step into the gap and to say, I will be a spiritual covering. I will protect. I will take care of my family and my church. So there are things that we need to be focused on this next generation, because every statistic says that men right now are struggling, especially young men that are coming out of high school, going into college. And it needs to be a priority for us to help them become strong men, because we have lots of daughters we're raising that need strong men. It's not one or the other. It's we have to elevate both. And we have to help them become those things, to have those skills, but at the same time that we're helping them become competent and strong. I can't make them any taller, ladies. I'm sorry. I know that like most women say, I'm looking for a guy that's 6 foot tall. And when I say that, I'm talking about younger women. I understand that we mature over time. But like very few men are 6 foot tall, and it's really hard to stretch out and make yourself taller. But proximity, what Ruth chose to do to come there, and Boaz choosing to do to be present in his field when he had managers that could have taken care of it by being close. And church, one of the things that we need to do is find more ways to get young people together, because in youth groups and in college ministries where men and women commingle, all of a sudden they see those other attributes just like Boaz had. Because again, he wasn't the most attractive. If he was, he probably would have been married already. But in his kindness and strength, so kindness, unfortunately for any man who's listening here or on the internet, kindness doesn't make a woman attracted to you. Strength and competence, those are the things that tend to bring that spark of attraction. But kindness and maturity and emotional intelligence, those are the things that make a woman want to commit to a man. And Boaz shows both. And we also cannot rule out, we can't forget the fact that God is doing something in their story in the same way he does for ours, that Boaz has likely had nights on his knees in prayer saying, God, all my friends, they're married, they have families, they have children, what do you have for me? And God had Boaz in the gap because he had a plan. He had a plan for Boaz. Not just to have a wife and a child, but that one day he would be the great-grandfather of David. the King of Israel, who is a picture of Jesus, and that his name would be in the genealogy of the Savior of all mankind. He may have had to be patient, and he had to wait, but God had a plan for him. And I think sometimes we want what we want, and we want it now. And we miss out on the fact that God may be holding us back. I mean, what is it mean to be holy? It means to be set apart, that God may be setting us apart from the things that our culture does for something better. And what God had for Boaz was something better. So we see that proximity, and it's partially the choice of Ruth to put herself out there despite there being risk and danger, for Boaz to put himself out there, that he chooses to be compassionate and kind. He goes the extra mile too here. If you remember from the text that we read, he says, why don't you go out and leave some extra grain behind? So he's telling his folks, in essence, don't do too good of a job. Make sure there's some good stuff for Ruth to pick up after you. So in verse 19, this is Naomi. Her mother-in-law asked her, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, this man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. Like I said, we'll talk more about that next week. Then Ruth the Moabite said, he even said to me, stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field, you might be harmed. So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So one, there's some time that passes. A lot of people think this was like a really fast thing. No, the whole harvest season takes place. And there's pretty good reason to believe that they didn't come at the end of harvest, that when there was food to be had, when there was a need there, they migrated sooner at the beginning. But we see a path in Naomi, and this is one that maybe more of us will relate to. Naomi goes from bitterness to blessing. Naomi, once blinded by bitterness, sees grace at work and guides Ruth. She says, he has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She even brings up the idea of the guardian redeemer, or in other translations you'll see kinship redeemer. Ruth know, or Naomi rather, knows what's happening here. And even in chapter 3 and chapter 4, as our story progresses, Ruth is careful to guide Naomi, or Naomi is careful to guide Ruth in the next step without revealing the whole picture. She's not doing this to deceive, but she's also not doing this to try and control. She's just allowing it to play out, and she's having her role as an encourager to be open to what God is doing. I think this is important. I have heard stories over the past few years of moms and grandmas saying some stuff that just disturbs me a little bit. One of them, there was a relationship between a young couple, and I thought it was kind of a cute relationship, but I'm not getting involved. I was just watching from afar. And then I find out that the mom and grandmother involved in it had kind of blown the whole thing up by telling the daughter, he's just too short for you. Like, you don't want to be with a short man. And I'm like, oh my goodness. Like, and maybe because I'm a guy, I hear that and feel a little worse. Like, I think for women to hear that a relationship is called off because things you can't change. I mean, it's not his fault that he wasn't tall. And maybe there was far more to it than that. But We have a tendency to open our mouth and sometimes we give some weird advice and some bad counsel. Sometimes it may come from a place where we were hurt and our own guardedness of our heart kind of wants to put a rein on the parade of someone else's new and exciting relationship. I've seen that happen too. But Naomi doesn't do that. She's coming from a place of bitterness. I mean, she changed her name. She said, from now on, you're going to call me bitter. And then she sees God working. And she allows that excitement to pivot. She goes back to Naomi. She goes back to being pleasant because she realizes that God is not only moving, but he's moving in a big way. And she's excited not to control, not to take over, but to be a mentor and a guide and take that place alongside Ruth. And I think that's something that we need to make sure we're careful to do with the young people in our lives. It's not our place to tell them what to do. And as a dad of daughters, that one's kind of hard for me. I want to be like, I have approval rights. I get to pick. That whole dowry thing starts to sound kind of good. Like, let them bring their package and financial offer and we'll talk. Because you girls were expensive. And if you don't think they're expensive in the younger years, just wait till they become teenagers. Oh my goodness. I love you. But we don't get to control. We have to trust God and watch, but we do have a place not to give unsolicited advice, but to be there when they come back to us and they say, what do I do? And in that moment, careful not to lay it all out, but to take them to the Lord in prayer, to help them bend their knee in prayer and say, God, please direct our next step, to be a source of encouragement and confirmation. Because God is doing something here. And if we're honest, in the lives of those that we love, in our own lives, God is doing something too. So to the Ruths in the room, stay faithful and keep going into the field. Put yourself out there, and if you're a Ruth that's looking for love, that's looking for what's next, maybe stay off the app and put yourself out there a little bit more because proximity is important. The person God has for you may not look like a 10, but when you get to know them and you see not just their kindness, but their inward strength, their ability to be there, they might be more attractive than you think. To the Boaz, use your strength to serve and protect. And for our young men, continue to build up competency because that's the one thing. The ability to be strong overcomes a lot. In fact, I was reading a book by Thomas Sowell, one of my favorite economists. And he talked about all of the gang violence that we see today. Much of it comes from a place where young men that have been relegated to a culture where men providing isn't important. It was one of the biggest problems the welfare state did. When you took away the need for men to provide, they stopped having that asset in the dating pool. So you had a lot of women who weren't looking for a man because they had Uncle Sam to take care of them. And then they had to find, how do I look strong? How do I become attractive? And violence became the next step. It was, how do I have influence and power? And that made them attractive. So building up your strength, not in violence. In fact, one of the best definitions of strength is having the ability to use violence, but the restraint to know not to. So it's strength. God isn't looking for men to be weak. He wants men to be strong but reserved. And that doesn't mean a bodybuilder. It means that we have that inner strength of character, that we can do the hard thing when the hard thing is needed, that we can stand and cover over those in our lives where we take and stand in the gap for them in prayer. We choose to have that role of spiritual covering. There's a lot more to it than just, I lift heavy weights. We need to use that not to get what we want, but to be a covering and a preserver of our family. And to the Naomis, to those of you who feel like maybe your love story already came and went, even in sorrow, God can use you to unlock someone else's future. If we're going to be successful, I believe one of the things we're going to do is we're going to mentor and we're going to build up and we're going to send out young people. But to do that, I need mentors and I need people to say, I'll raise my hand and I'm going to be there as another mother figure or grandmother figure or father figure or grandfather figure to the young men and women that we disciple. It's been pretty cool. Ella brought him into the board meeting a few months ago, but we had a whole big group of young women, college and high school, that are meeting together. And maybe you would say, you know what? I'd like to befriend. I'd like to come and be an encourager. Maybe it's just writing notes to them or making sure that you're praying with them and for them. It's amazing. For men and women, we can all take that role of mentoring and discipling the next generation. Not to control them, not to make their choices for them, but to get to be a part of God's story unveiling and being rolled out in their life.